Welcome to the Land Jam Podcast, a semi-friendly discussion between two blokes on watches, cars, and everything in between. Now, here are your hosts, Tommy and Sanjeev.
Welcome to the Land Jam Podcast, episode 36, an interview with Alistair of ATT Vintage.
Alistair, welcome. This is honestly, we're really honored to have you. This is a huge day for the podcast. So thank you for joining us.
It's very nice to be here.
Yeah. And, you know, I think people who've been listening to the podcast know that, you know, we're enthusiasts. We've been into watches for, you know, 5 or 6 years. We're relatively new into watches. But Alistair, you know, you have a history of watches going really quite far back. I mean, is it fair to say back into the 90s, maybe even earlier?
Yeah, it was online was sort of late 90s. I mean, it was on my own. There were a lot of guys, but you could basically count the amount of guys online who had websites selling and, you know, sort of appreciating watches. It wasn't just me, but there weren't that many.
And how did you kind of find this weird space? Is this professionally what you do, or how did you discover watches as an interest or a hobby?
I initially started collecting them because I was always very interested in them and the sort of technical aspect. And I did a lot of traveling with my job, and I was, you know, sort of 25, getting on for late 20s when I sort of was doing a lot of this traveling, and I had a bit of spare cash, and I'd go to markets when I was in different cities and stuff in Europe. And, you know, and I'd check out watches and buy this and buy that. And then, because my background was in TV and we had big pie connections to the internet early on, I suddenly realized there was a whole world online talking about watches.
And what brand kind of did you gravitate to back in those early days? Were you like a Rolex person or?
No, not really. I mean, in those days, Rolex, when you thought Rolex, you thought two-tone date just on some second-hand car dealer who, you know, I mean, you didn't think blonde 6'7" wife on the private jet landing in Dubai. You just didn't think that. It wasn't what you thought. You thought cool watch, but too much brand, and it wasn't very classy. They weren't considered very classy. They're still not really.
Yeah, you know, this is my usual, you know, this is the watch for dentists argument that I brought up with Sam.
Well, Daytonas were the watch for the guy, the small business guy who made it. The idea that people will go to a shop and put their name on a list and pay a deposit of maybe like $4,000 or $5,000 now, because they're like 12 for a Daytona, right?
Right.
10 years ago, 12 years ago, they were six. Now they're 12. Why?
Why is that happening?
And why have people gone, yeah, okay. And why you're running your own business and your idea of having a good time is to go and lay off $4,000 or $5,000 to a retailer who's like, brilliant. And then you sit there for like 4 years before you get a watch. That's the same as everyone else at your golf club. I mean, I don't get that at all. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's basically an archetype now, right? It's the same guy. There's just one guy that does that sort of thing.
Yeah, but he shouldn't be paying that much money.
Yeah, it's
or have to wait. Having to wait 2 years for it's insane.
Honestly, in Britain, 2 years. The other thing that's funny about Britain is everyone thinks, well, you know, if they're not selling it in Britain, then it's not really being sold.
Yeah,
we've still got this holdover with watches, which I discovered because I came from a different kind of discipline. We've got this holdover, like, well, if it's not sold in Britain, then it doesn't exist. And I was like, oh wow, I discovered really early. Britain isn't really a massive market for very expensive watches, and how all watch companies historically were like, get to the American market, get to the American market.
And if you get to Britain, drop a couple on the way.
Yeah, I mean, Rolex shops there's very few that you'll Rolex shops in Britain that you'll walk into that will have Daytonas in the window or anything like that, or even Submariners.
Yeah.
I mean, the few times I've walked around authorized Rolex dealers here around my area, like basically like the space where, you know, the booths and all how they showcase their watches, they're basically practically empty. It's insane. Like,
yeah.
How like you if just you can't get
it. If you want to try Cellini, you can try Cellini. Well, that's pretty much.
Yeah. I quite like, I like the modern Cellini. Is it Cellini is how you'd say it? The modern ones are much nicer than the old ones. The old ones are shit. That's why nobody wore them. I didn't know about them for quite a while. And then I was like, oh, they made these other ones, which are weird.
Just lying around, yeah.
Meanwhile, the Tudor like showcase tables are like completely filled with like watches that I think, you know, Tommy and I would agree to like say gravitate towards versus say Rolex.
I think there's a price point thing there, boys, isn't there?
Well, yeah, obviously.
It's like half the price.
If you could drop 16 grand, or in the US it'd be 24 or something like that, on one of those really nice detailed bezel Daytonas that you then could take to an expert polisher who'd brush it all for you so it'd be matte, you'd be wearing one of those.
Yeah. I think Sanj is thinking of, and I would too.
Sorry.
Yeah. I think Sanj is thinking of the Black Bay GMT versus the modern Rolex GMT, right? Because the Black Bay GMT has a lot of those vintage callbacks that we really like. And like you said, you could buy one, you could buy a Rolex and kind of modify it to look like it. But Tudor kind of, I think, understands that up front and kind of knows what at least some of the enthusiasts are kind of into.
Well, Tudor just acts as like the other half of the market. For Rolex, the
poorer schmucks like us.
The hopeful schmucks like us.
They've always been like that. It's nothing's new.
Yeah.
You know, and the way Rolex is going, I mean, Rolex is a machine in itself. I mean, it's not really part of the watch world, not really. Doing its own thing.
You think it's just
money?
There's
a handful of watches that are status, and they're not really watches. They're just money. So AP Offshore, any of the bigger priced Rolexes.
Patek Nautilus.
Yeah, the Nautilus. Yeah, that's another one. I thought it's all the Genta ones. It's largely the Genta.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't like the Genta watches. They're shit. They just really? Look like coach bolts with a dial in them. There's nothing groovy about them at all. And they're like... They've made them complicated. Have you ever seen a Nautilus taken apart?
No, I haven't, no.
Yeah, it's quite complicated how they put it together.
Yeah.
Why?
Yes, I've seen like one of those blog like three diagrams.
Layers.
Yes, why? Exactly, yeah.
Like Hublot. It's basically three things screwed together with, and every time you got screws, you know, when they tighten them because they've taken it apart or they've had to take it apart, you can nick those screws and they're on the face. So, you know, and it's just all bollocks because, well, essentially Rolex did the Datejust, you know, the it's not the Datejust, but the their case with the screwing crown, right? The Oyster case.
Yes.
Right. That's it. You don't need any more than that.
Nothing more complicated than
No. And so everything else is like, I mean, I just don't like the Genta watches at all. it's like that thing where, you know, what's that luggage that has the fleur-de-lis on it that, you know, it's brown, it has gold fleur-de-lis on it all over.
Is it Louis Vuitton or something?
Louis Vuitton, right?
Yeah.
Go to an expert saddle maker and have him make you a custom leather bag exactly how you want it.
Yeah.
That's what real money does. Right, money doesn't buy brands. It has things made.
Bespoke, I think, is the word, right?
Bespoke's the word, yeah.
Yeah.
So the whole gender thing, it just drives up the fucking wall. It's just, you know, let's take this great movement that Patek came up with I think Universal maybe and a few others, with the micro rotor, and it's a really cool movement, and we'll put it in a rectangular block of steel.
Yeah, and then sell
why
that.
Do that? Honestly, I mean, there are a few AP Offshore chronographs. They even use a 7750 movement in there in the cheapest setup.
Yeah.
Up, down, right? And date on the right is the cheapest incarnation of the 7750.
Right.
If you do anything else with it, you want to turn it, like Bremont have done with the tri-compacts, you know, 12 hours at the bottom and the date in the corner. That's very expensive to do that. It's like maybe three times more expensive to get that incarnation than
modify maybe. That.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I first started understanding in like, I know, the late 90s about movements and stuff, and I'd look at the AP offshore, it'd be, I don't know, I think it were maybe $9,000, the standard chronograph. I was like, that's the cheapest movement you can fucking make. Oh my God. And I was just thinking, how much are these people making?
Yeah, yeah, the
retailers making 40%, there's 20%, and they're still making a fortune. That's how cheap some of
that's
their
ones. Unbelievable.
But they have made some really cool ones. They made an F1 Rubens Barrichello one.
Yes, yes, yes.
You ever see that with the pushers were like the air intake from, I mean, it's not going to last because you're going to break that. But it was, you know, fucking cool. It's like the Universal Space Compacts is another super cool watch with rubber pushers from the 60s.
Yes.
The rubber pushers don't work. I owned like 8 of them and a load of their cases. Like, I think I was talking on the other podcast with Matt that I used to buy watch parts from this Italian guy in Rome. Yeah. And I never spoke to him. And I did, he had like 10, he had 40 new all stock Universal Space Compacts cases.
Wow.
40.
Wow.
And I bought 10.
Yeah.
And they were like $30 each, 30 euros each.
Wow.
And when they arrived, they all had these perfect rubber pushers. And you push them and they just went. There was a time during the 60s where they developed rubber that would be, you could form it into small stuff.
Right.
But what happened was over time, because they obviously didn't test it long enough.
Yeah.
It started losing its integrity. So you press them and you just go. And then it would deform. And I was like, okay, so they're fucked then.
Yeah.
That's why. It didn't go to the moon, or you know, there's all that crap.
That's
about
the failure. Yeah.
Wasn't it in the trials for the moon watch? And it was like, oh yeah, well they didn't want it because they didn't like the crown. Like, no, it didn't fucking work. That's why they didn't want it. So when you see all those Universal Space Compacts, I don't. Do you know this watch, Universal Space Compacts?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. If whenever you see them and they're all like perfect, I'm just like, some sucker is going to buy that. And he's going to realize he can wear it, but he can't press any of the buttons.
Can't do it.
And if he catches his sweater on it, it's going to tear out the rubber.
Game over. Yeah.
Yeah. Watch. That's where they've gone. They suddenly went to $25,000 and then suddenly they're back down to like $8,000 again.
Watch that.
Which
that
is still a lot. Yeah.
Whereas I had a problem selling them for like £1,800, all perfect.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, and people would go, why do I want to buy this? And I was like, I had a guy here. I live in like the 7th biggest town in city in England. And this guy contacted me and said, I really like this watch. Small business owner, so he's used to doing a bit of a deal.
Yeah.
We'll go for a coffee down the road on the high street. So I go down there with him and I put this watch. And it's a very beautiful watch and it was perfect. Yeah. And he says to me, so why should I pay £1,800 for this watch? And I was like, because that's how much it costs. And he was like, yeah, but where's the economy of scale? And I said, look, this isn't a coach bolt. What do you do for a living? And he was like, you know, earth mover or something. And I was like, yeah, well, when you buy earth, in the winter, it's more expensive because it's wet and therefore heavier. And then in the summer, it's lighter, so therefore, right? And he was like, and I just made this up. And he was like, yeah. And I was like, okay, this isn't that. All right, this is the watch you were wearing in the 60s, stepping off your Riva motorboat at Monaco to go for dinner with your wife. It doesn't get cooler.
Yeah.
And he was like, I think it's too much money. That was it.
That was the end of that deal.
Don't worry.
I didn't live in London, you see. If I was in London, I'd just stand out in the street and hold it like that.
Yeah. Someone will show up.
Can I buy that? And I'd go, yeah, sure. There you go. Because I was stuck in Bristol with the kids.
That poor sod that's going to buy Universal Space Compacts could be me in the future because it does look cool.
It's a very cool watch. It's a beautiful watch. The case is unbelievable, but they also made it with stainless steel pushers. And FYI, you can take the armored shoulders off and put Speedmaster pushers in.
Oh,
I actually
really?
Do see that. I'm looking up the Universal Space Compacts on, I know, just in Google Images. And yeah, I do see some with like the pushers from like a Speedmaster.
Yeah, they made them with their own, with steel pushers as well. Basically, okay. I don't think many of those watches were sold because, okay, the integrity of the rubber on the pushers wasn't great by the time I got hold of them, sort of 30 years later or 35 years later. But at the time, they probably weren't that great either because they were pressing on a spike.
Yeah.
Mm. So you're going to, you know, it's going to disintegrate.
It's going to wear down eventually. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I'd hit eBay in like 2001, there'd be, we hired all these like not secret searches, but searches that I knew, like I'd look for a Valjoux 72, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because what was really, which is a for those who don't know, Valjoux 72 is a tri-compax configuration chronograph with a 12-hour recorder at the bottom, 30 minutes and the seconds on the left, right? They were a really good standard watch. And then what I realized was when you look at the date of some of these watches, and this was at the time, when you're seeing like that NASA were looking for watches, every watch company suddenly went, here's our Bell 72 12-hour chronograph, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ernest Borrell, who made cocktail watches for girls, right?
Yeah.
Never made a watch bigger than 31 millimeters, suddenly created a Valjoux 72 tri-compax with a bezel, waterproof to 30 ATM, right?
Yeah.
So that's why there's loads of these Val 72 watches. And over time, people have told other people about Val 72 is a big deal.
Yeah.
And now, and I've just watched it, and I'm just sat there going, why are you telling everybody?
Keep it to yourself.
Do you want to hear? This is a brilliant story. Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I was buying all of these Mark II Speedmasters, right? Which had all been badly done, and I was, you know, people take, you know, what do you call it, wet and dry, and try and put the brush back on them and all that kind of stuff, and they just wreck them. And I was like, great, so I can buy that for $300, $350 maybe. I'll get him to send it to Jack, who International Watch, Jack Alexon, who did loads of customized watches. He's still in operation. Mm-hmm. But I did it when you were cheap, Jack, before you got expensive, if he ever hears this. good, really good guy. And so I'd send him a blah, blah. A guy contacts me, joins my forum in this small town in Bristol and says, I'm really interested in Speedmaster watches.
Yeah.
And I go, cool. And then he starts telling me about the Omega Speedmasters. This is in about 2006, right?
Yeah.
And I said, okay. And I said, well, do you want to just, I would keep people at the level of text or email for a while, right? Because you didn't know who you were dealing with.
Yeah.
And in the end, I said, look, Gary, it's my telephone number, just call me. So he calls me and we get chatting, and it turns out he lives in like four roads away from me.
No kidding.
Like a third of a block away.
Yeah, right?
And he's like, well, the thing about Speedmasters, and I like this one, that one, but you know how they are, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, I don't think you do know how they are. Okay. And I think you don't really understand who I am. And I went, okay. Let's meet for a beer in that nice bar, blah, 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 which is the bottom of his road. And he was like, okay. So I take a roll of watches with me. And we sit down, and he's from Crewe, which is an important town historically in the north of England.
Hometown of Bentley.
Trains with, it's where Rolls-Royce are in Crewe and all that.
Oh, yeah, Crewe, you're right, Rolls-Royce.
I'm from Liverpool. It's about 40 miles where I'm from. So we speak the same kind of language. Gotcha. So he sits down and he goes, blah, 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 Speedmaster. And I want this and I want that. I'm like, okay, here's the Speedmaster book. And if you go to this page, opens out to like eight pages of Speedmasters, right? And I went, here you go, Japanese book. And he opens it. And I'm taking on my role. And I'm doing my role. And I've got Movado Subsea Diver. I've got Caliber 15 Monaco. I've got a 5513. I've got 5508 No Crown Guard Submariner. I've got a Dato 45 Carrera. And then he suddenly, and then he looks over it and he goes, yeah, I don't know anything about Speedmasters. I meant, no, you don't. There's no, like 300 of them. Because he was being really vague. I like the blue one with the green bit. And I was like, you need this book. And then I said, and these are my watches that I've got at the moment. And he was like, okay, I don't really know, do I? And I'm like, no, you don't. So anyway, so I put them all away. But anyway, he wanted an exotic dial Mark II Speedmaster. And this is what's happened with, this is where the turning from chatting on the internet and having a good time and sharing kind of fucked up, right? And I said to him, okay. He said, I want to buy this, you know, and he was quite chatty and, you know, and I was a young dad and I didn't know many people in town. I thought, well, he's a cool guy and stuff. And I said, okay, this is how you do it. And I gave him a dealer secret. And I told him, what you do is find a beat up Mark II Speedmaster exotic dial on eBay, a real battered one. Yeah. Well, I don't run a real, but I was like, shut up, just find one. Yeah. And then let me know, right? And I said, and then what you do is, Omega just created their website, right? So they had a holding page, really, and you could contact them.
Yeah.
Omega, I mean, when I first started doing this, watch shops didn't have, watch businesses, brands didn't have websites. Wow. No, it's not that long ago, they didn't have websites.
Yeah.
It was, I was like, when the fuck are these guys going to get it? So anyway. But what I knew was you can email the service department in Bienne, in Switzerland. Yeah. And you can say, I've got this Mark II Exotic Dial Speedmaster. Can you service it for me? And they go, yeah, sure. Send it to this address. Use FedEx. Use this code and it'll get in the country. Right?
Yeah.
So I told him. And then he sent me a thing from Watchco, who were the Australian guys who were selling loads of Amiga stuff.
Those Seamaster 300s, those guys.
Yeah, Watchco, well, I wrote a whole article about that going, They're all fake. And it wasn't put online because a week later, Omega announced they will verify your watch.
Oh.
Omega have been verifying these watches for a long time.
Yeah.
Right? And then someone went, do you know, like a lot of them haven't got the dials that they originally came with. So, I mean, I don't mind if it's the right dial, put it in. But when you're messing around.
Yeah. So anyway. Franken watches.
Yeah. Well, kind of 6-1 after the other. I mean, yeah, but I'm not that tight ass about it anyway, really. But I am tight ass about people going, look at this, isn't it brilliant? Check out my FP June and my military Seamaster that's worth 20 grand. And I'm like, yeah, that dial didn't come with that watch. That's what I'm not happy about.
That's who you pick apart.
The thing is, if you know, it gets annoying. You see things online that you guys know that you go, that's bullshit.
Yeah, that's
so true. Anyway. So I tell him how to do it. So he sends me this in Watchco, $320. And I go, okay, Watchco are a proper company. Get them to send it to Bien. So he sends his watch to Bien.
Right.
Right. And I'm not paying attention because I got life and all the rest of it. And then he calls me and says, do you want to go for a coffee? Blah, blah, blah. And I was working from home. It was like 11 o'clock, go for a coffee. So I go meet him. He pulls out this watch. Right?
Yeah.
And it's a Mark II Speedmaster and it's perfect. The case has been relapped. I mean, it looks brand new, new dial, new handset, original movements, pressure tested. And then he's got a bag of all the parts, right?
Right.
And he said to me, it cost £320.
Wow.
Right? And I was like, yeah. And I said, don't tell anybody because this is like a dealer thing, and any dealers know this. Because if you took a watch into an Omega dealer in England, then they went, oh, well, it's gonna, well, immediately you double the price because the retailer's gonna charge you. That's how that network works, right?
Sure.
And then
it would go to a restoring
place in England, and the only time it would go to Switzerland was if they just order parts or even a complete new movement, and you'd never know. But he sent to Switzerland to do it properly.
Wow.
So he then goes on to the largest web forum in Britain, run by a guy called Eddie Platt, who's a good guy who was very cool with me. He'd been going about 4 or 5 years when I started. And it's, I don't know, at the time it had about 25,000 members, and told the story of how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that was the end of it.
Is that still around? Could someone still do that? Or
yeah, someone still wants to do that, and it'll take 8 months and it'll cost you $1,200.
Still not a bad deal for something if you get a really good deal on the broken up Speedmaster in the first place, you know?
Yeah, but not when it only costs, you know what I mean? I was like, what did you do that for? And you know that thing about oversharing? Well, there's an example of oversharing. I was like, why have you done that? And he was like, well, I thought I'd let other people. I went, 20,000 people you don't know. You got this from me. And you're my neighbor. That's why I told you.
And I
had a couple of guys who I knew were collectors who knew about this contact me and say, did you tell that guy about? And I was like,
God damn.
No. And they were like, yes, you did. Because he's based in Bristol and you're based in Bristol.
It had to be you.
About that. They were American guys just going, fucking hell, you fucked that up. Because they were sending things like massively battered Plo Prof original.
Yeah.
And having them completely done for like $350.
Oh my God.
Wow. Oh.
I really wish we met a lot earlier.
I know. I wish we got into the scene a lot.
But I wouldn't have told you in case you went online and told everyone else about it.
Yeah. Well, Sanjay has a big mouth, so he
can't keep so insulted. So insulted.
So Alistair, that was fantastic. So what is the genesis of the forum? Why did you set one up? How did that kind of take off? What's the story there?
The idea was forum creates traffic, creates this, creates that. I mean, I put a gallery on the forum, which no forums had galleries on at the time.
And what year is this, by the way? When did you launch the forum?
The first forum was about 2001.
Oh, wow.
And then I switched it to V-Bulletin, which was the standard forum, about 3 years later. But this is how I started a forum. I sat in the forum and I posted pictures of watches and talked about them.
Yeah.
I posted about 1,300 posts before anyone spoke.
Just talking to yourself.
No, I'm lying. That's a joke that I've created for another story. About 700 posts before somebody went. Because nobody knew how it worked. Because I was quite technical. Yeah. This is the stage where, I mean, when I first was chatting on forums, when you posted a watch, you posted the URL in code live into the box. There was no, you know, sunny picture that you clicked and then you put the URL in or uploaded. You actually had to do the code, which I worked out how to do. And it wasn't much beyond that. So people didn't know how to do it. But also they were a bit like, this guy really knows about watches and I don't really know. And I'd be just like, will somebody talk? Like, subject.
Please.
And I'd have a picture in the post of like a little dog on its own.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Going like lonely dog. And then suddenly it all started. It like all, and I'd, you know, there was an Australian guy who was a surgeon. We had a few guys in Bristol suddenly were very chatty. Loads of guys in America, because I was on a forum called the Equation of Time Forum, which is, do you know that forum?
No.
Unfamiliar.
Okay, well, it used to, there's a forum missing from their forums, which was called the Dive Forum.
Okay.
And the Dive Forum was very cool, very well trafficked. And that I would post pictures of watches, because I suddenly was selling watches. So it was like shilling and I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
So I and they were like, yeah, we don't, because I took quite good photographs at a time when people didn't take good photographs.
Right.
And they were like, fuck it, just post them because we really like the pictures. And I'd give them a little bit of what you think of this, blah, blah, blah. And that was a really cool forum. And I was on the Dash forum run by Jeff Stein, which is the Hoyer forum.
I know, on the Dash. Yeah.
Well, because originally what I did was I collected Hoyers and I sold them, not all of them, but I sold some of them to the Tag Heuer Museum.
Wow. Okay. Did you have any notable pieces and anything?
You argued about the money.
They argued about the money?
Yeah. I sold the Caliber 15 blue dial Monaco.
Wow. Okay.
And Monaco cases, yeah. right? They look flat.
Yeah.
But Monaco cases aren't flat. The tops of them are bowed. But if they've been brushed too much, they're flat. Right?
I see.
Now there's a secret. If you buy Monaco that's completely flat on top, it's been overbrushed.
Yeah. It's been overbrushed.
Oh, okay.
Nobody mentions that anymore.
Yeah.
Like when people used to sell Submariners, they used to hold them by the bracelet. They used to hold them like that.
Ah, okay.
So you could see the bend.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Well, that stopped almost as soon as it started, because it was like, fuck, to refurb a bracelet from Rolex meant you had to buy a new Rolex.
Oh,
God. So everyone stopped doing it. But that's how they used to be sold. People would hold them like that to show how much play was in the bracelet.
Right.
Yeah, that stopped. No, so I think I sold, because none of the brands had started this museum thing yet or archive, none of them.
Right.
And then Hoya kind of went, I actually had a conversation with Jean-Paul Papin, who was the CEO of Tag.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He just started talking to me because I had these IDF Hoyas, which I posted the other day on Instagram.
Right, yes.
With Ready Defense Force issue Hoyas. And he suddenly talked to me on the forum and then he emailed me and said, we don't know about these watches. We're trying to set up a da da da. Have you got any watches? And this is my assistant. He's like, brilliant CEO. Have a really good chat with me and then go, anyway, speak to her because I'm really busy. And I think I sold Caliber 15, which is the Hoya Micro-Rotor movement with the just the triangle in the top corner. It doesn't really do anything, but it looks groovy.
Yeah.
Blue Monaco. When all the springs worked, because the way the Monaco case works is quite nuts. It's got like spring-loaded little chocks that hold it together. It's kind of shit, really, but don't tell it. No, I know it is. Honestly, it's terrible. If you spill a glass of water on it, that's the end of it.
That's the end.
Yeah.
That's the running joke with the Speedmaster. And mm-hmm.
Yes, and you say that, and you say that, and then I was away with my kids when they were little on holiday in Britain, and I took them to a swimming pool, and there was a guy who was about a bit older than me, in good shape. He was probably about 50. I was about late 30s, and he had a Speedmaster on the pool, and I got chatting to him, and he said he was an army officer, and I got chatting. I said, "Are you wearing that in the pool?" And he was like, "Yeah." And I went, I really wouldn't if I were you because, you know, and he was like, I've had it for 20 years and I've always worn it swimming.
Holy.
Wow.
And I was like, and I looked at it, it wasn't flooded. And I was like, wow. Well, let me tell you, it's now worth about $4,000.
And to find out. Yeah.
Don't swim with it. And he was like, good to know. So but no, the Monaco is much worse than that. You can even see through between the case. There's seal. There's no rubber seal between the case goes on top like that. There's no rubber seal. And the other thing is, which nobody talks about, is this thing about this rubber for like the universal pushers, right?
Yep.
So a lot of the rubber, as soon as like, we can make rubber in very small gaskets, right?
Yeah.
Which they call like seals for case backs and stuff.
Yep.
Like with the Monaco is what's called a top hat crystal. So the crystal sits on top of the dial and then the case goes on top. The top case goes on top.
Right.
And the crystal sits on a rubber square gasket that sits on the dial. Well, what happened with that rubber is it lost its, it became viscous and wrecked the outside of the dials.
Oh.
It didn't happen with all of them, but it happened with some. So what I've noticed now is you see pictures and they never show it square on or a close up because the outside edge, because it basically tore off the coating of the dial on the outside edge.
Oh,
gotcha. Okay.
And it happened. I had it with two Monacos and I had it with a Movado Pilot, which is the big mad pilot watch that has a, and I bought one of those and my watchmaker went, I can't take it apart. I'm going to tear the dial to pieces to take the crystal off it.
Yeah.
So So that was one of those like technological things that didn't quite work, but they used it because they were like, well, we can make cool shaped watches.
Yeah.
All the Hoya guys are gonna hate me about the monocle.
Well, I want to pick your brain a little bit, Alistair. I mean, if you know, obviously with the internet exploding, the chances of finding a hidden gem where the seller doesn't know the true value of the watch, I mean, I think those days are kind of gone, right? I mean, everyone knows a little bit of everything, and that kind of price disparity has kind of come somewhere more normalized. But where do you see as probably the best value for vintage watches now? I mean, what are you interested in? Well, what do you think people aren't paying attention to?
First of all, you think you do. But that's working on the idea that what you're reading on the internet is the truth.
Okay.
And a lot of it isn't. I've just told you about Hoya Monacos. About Hoya Monacos. If they're flat on top, that means they've been overbrushed.
Oh, yeah.
They should be curved.
Right. Yeah.
And that the dials, if you look at the very edge, you need to be able to see. What will happen is they'll use a rubber gasket that is slightly inside the crystal, so you won't see that it's torn the edge of the dial.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Well, you didn't know that, did you?
No, I didn't. But no, what I no, mean
I'm
is,
just using you as an example. I'm not saying you didn't know that.
Yeah, no. But what I meant is, as far as models and brands, are there certain underappreciated kind of brands that you've kind of discovered that I think the general public don't know, or something that we should keep an eye on and focus on? I don't know, because you have such a wide breadth in the vintage watch space. And that's also a deep breath because you've been in it for so long. For Sanj and me, it's like, you know, 5-6 years, it's nothing. Like,
yeah.
We know nothing. And
honestly, we base our knowledge, you know, really from the internet.
Yeah. And people like you who write articles is kind of our glimpse into the world. So like, for once, I'd like to be like on the inside and kind of know a brand or a model that you're kind of, you know, paying attention to and kind of be on the inside of that. I guess that's my question.
Well,
or you can't share.
There are, I'm not sure I'm prepared to tell him. We can go off recording.
We'll go offline. Okay, that's fair.
But it's not like I know. It's not like I know shit that people don't know. It's not that. It's just that I look at it differently. What's happened with watches is, after 2008, money just went into everything. Cars. You know, money has always, when money hasn't made money in investments, it's always gone into gold, property, physical stuff, right?
But what happened was,
there was so much information about watches on the internet. Suddenly you've got people who are basically creating investment portfolios based on that, right?
Yeah.
You know, which, what that is a value 7733 30 minute Kallek. It's called a Kallek, but it's the same as a Bulova Blue Sky.
Okay.
Yeah. Which I created the name of by calling it Blue Sky. And then I see it put on eBay as Blue Sky. And I think that's quite funny.
You know, you have fans. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, they don't know. I came up with it. It's the same as, you know, it's the same as me telling you the association that suddenly everyone has with the Hoya Bund and the F-104.
Starfighter.
I made that up. I said this
watch, and now it's on listings.
Watch from 1965. Okay, the Germans had it. What were they flying in 1965? What were Germany flying in? Oh, 104 Starfighters. They were really fast. They look cool, but they were always planting them all over Germany. Okay,
it's,
cool.
It's a Widowmaker.
Got a picture of that. I'll talk about that. How cool this watch is. Literally 15 years later, there are people going, well, it's the, you know, the watch worn by the 104 Star. And I'm like, I made that up. You don't know they did. They were very expensive watches. Maybe they were the Starfighters. Who fucking knows? But you know, well, honestly, there's a load of watches like that. There's another one I can find, Amiga Seamaster.
You're making me question everything. I can't believe anything anyone tells me anymore.
Yeah, you can. But if you ruminate on what I've told you, you'll be able to look at it and you'll be able to see this language.
Yeah, I
see stuff and I see the language and I can see whether somebody wants to sell it badly or not. I can tell by what they're saying or how they're photographing it, you know, and stuff like that. Right, what can I tell you? I don't like giving advice about investments for free because people pay me to do that.
Sure. No. But only from an enthusiast angle, you know. I think that's
really exactly, which has always been, I've always given. I mean, what you want to do is you want to go buy movements.
Yeah.
Okay.
And don't think if I spend this, it's going to be worth that, right?
Yeah.
Each purchase you make, it's yours. You bought it.
Live with it.
You didn't, live with it. You didn't buy it to, you know, I mean, you can end up, I mean, the same guy that I told you about who did the thing with the Mark II Speedmaster, who, by the way, now works for Bremont. Right?
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Can we do that for Bremont's? Just buy a broken up Bremont?
No. He's a good guy. He just completely changed career and became a watchmaker, which I think is, it's very brave in your 40s to completely change what you want to do. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I went around to his house once. He went, I need you to look at something. And he had, you know, when there's watch cases where people have watches, like you guys sent me a picture of what watches you had. He had 50 watches.
Wow.
And he owned them. And he had like three of that one and two of that one. And I was like, why have you got that? Why have you got multiple versions of the same watch?
Yeah.
And it's because they were cheap and because he knew a bit. So he bought them. And I'm like, okay, well, you can get rid of like 18 watches because you've got them. So what?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's human nature. It's how people are. Do you know what I mean?
They just like to collect.
Yeah, and so, you know, well, let's have four of the same thing. Whereas I'm utterly, I don't know why I'm in this business, because I'm not obsessed compulsive about anything.
Yeah.
Really. My problem was I had all these amazing collection watches and then I put them in my safe and then I never touched them again. Because actually it was the restoring them that was the thing for me.
Right.
But I would say to anyone, really, if you're going to buy a watch, early automatic watches are not a great investment in terms of, I don't mean investment. I'm not talking about investment here. I'm talking about quality, right?
Right.
Early, you know, early Seamasters that have got bumper automatic movements. I don't know if you know how they work. So you think there's a spring here, there's a spring there. And instead of it going all the way around, it just bounces between the two. It didn't really work. It wasn't used for very long. So they created the oscillating.
Right.
So it's a cool watch and it's a nice watch, but then it shouldn't be valuable just because it says Seamaster on it.
Right.
And this
is
what's happened with the investing thing, is they're pushing the brand names. And Instagram, it's all like brand name, brand name, brand name. Because you don't get to say, well, actually, that movement's shit.
Yeah.
There was always a thing with forums where somebody would jump in and go, or they'd send you a message. If it was a civilized forum, they wouldn't just say it. They'd send you a message, go, look, that movement's shit. If I were you, I'd get rid of it. Because I've done one of those. And my watchmaker, and
XYZ, yeah.
Yeah. And that had all happened. And then 2010 and Instagram, suddenly wiped everyone's brain. And the next generation came along. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You guys were like, okay, I'll do it.
Looks cool.
It's because you didn't know. Honestly, I watched it happen. I was like, fucking hell. They're just wiping everyone's brain. So, you know, things like that, things like really don't get take carried away by the brand name.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, there are some shit movements that in watches, that old watches that look good. The watch looks good.
Yeah.
But if you want to actually use it.
Yeah.
You know, it's gonna be fit for purpose in my book. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my thing. It just has to be fit for purpose. So movements, you know, I cannot understand how there are all these late 60s, early 70s, cheap ass dive watch brands like Caravelle and Sakura.
Mm-hmm.
That are expensive because they're all using AA Shield movements or variations of, which weren't very good, right? Mm-hmm. If Rolex weren't using them or Omega weren't using them or Zenith weren't using them, why weren't they using them? And it's because they were fine and they'll work, but they won't work. Well, they might work forever because the standard was very high, but they're still not great, right? Yeah. I can't have somebody showing me something that's kind of broken down and a bit shit and try and make out it's good. Do you know what I mean? I'd find it disturbing that this is like an online phenomenon where people will go, yeah, but look, it's all old. And I'm like, so fucking what? Especially in Britain. Britain, you know, I live in a modern kind of exec flat, right?
Yeah.
Apartment, you know, off-street parking, nice, you know, secure, all that kind of shit. But the houses on the front were from like 1880.
Yeah.
The whole of Britain's old.
Yeah,
it's, you know, it's about quality, that we're, and it doesn't have to be anything flash. It can just be something quite interesting. There you go. There's a Seiko on my. Can you see?
Yeah, I can see.
Yeah.
What is that? Is that I can't read the.
Don't. I don't want to know what the serial number is. I do not want to know. It's a 2184 from 1971. Don't care. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Seiko are the kids' scooter from that period. This is my opinion.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, I've been drinking.
This is gonna be good.
But from the American culture, right? You've got a V8 muscle car, right?
Yeah.
And then you've got those kids' scooters where they hold on, they push like that.
Yep.
Sure. Yeah. Okay,
well, that's Seiko. Compared to a Rolex Submariner, right?
Wow, fighting words.
Oh,
look,
it's a different, it's a completely different philosophy between these two companies, right? I mean, it's a different approach.
Japan went after the Second World War, apparently everyone says they did a 100-year plan, but they wouldn't have fucked up so much in the 80s if they had. So I don't think it was a 100-year plan. And I was in Japan in 1990, and they were walking around going, yeah, we kind of fucked up. And I was like, yeah, you really have. But what they did was they just targeted stuff that they could make cheaper and better because they weren't tied into, you know, it's like you being able to, the micro brands can go, well, I can do this. Dan Henry, well, you know, I can copy the Hamilton chronograph and I can copy the Porsche design and I can make it out of quartz or automatic, whatever he's doing. But it's all going to be cheaper because he's only going to sell 500 of them.
Yeah.
If he wants to sell 20,000 of them, he's got a fucking problem because Porsche will go, that's my our watch. You're not doing it, right?
Right.
And that's kind of what Japan did with lightweight motorbikes, you know, 125 Hondas, and little Suzukis. And then they do the odd cool one and all that because they knew what they were doing. It wasn't like, they could only make shit motorbikes. They just made ones that would work for everyone. And that's where the Swatch idea came from. You know, who fucking own everybody, by the way.
Yeah.
Swatch
group. You know, and that's all fine. But having handled so many of these watches, the quality isn't the same. Mm-hmm. Because they weren't the same. You know, at the time... You know, a Rolex sub was probably 350 and a Pogue was like $55 or $65. It's not going to be the same. And I get that, and that's absolutely fine. But, and let me put this, if anyone who listens to this has got my book or read it, I had a lot of shit from Seiko fans. So why is there no Seikos? Well, if you read my book, the book is all about, I bought these watches to restore and sell, right? At the time, I could buy a Pogue for £60.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
But I could only sell it for 150.
Yeah. The margin just isn't there for that.
But just wasn't there.
Yeah.
And also, Seiko in England, it was very difficult to get vintage parts. They didn't want to give you parts. I mean, I've restored a load of, hang on, while we're having this conversation, and you might want to tell the listeners what I'm doing.
That's the question. There we go.
Oh, got a Seiko background here. All right. Got the pole in the upper.
But I've reversed this one. So it's
okay,
it's all
I can actually front. See it now. I see a Captain Willard. I got the RAF Gen 1 chronograph lower right. Oh,
okay. So you there's your watch. Willard.
Yeah, that's
there's
fine.
Your watch I restored for a friend of mine. He was a Royal Navy clearance diver.
Okay, okay.
Who wore it in the 80s.
That's awesome. I love that
And he
watch.
Told me it wasn't very good.
No. You know, I was expecting a lot of fire.
If you look at your watch, I don't know whether it's yours. Okay. See how it's got dirt inside the corners of those boxes? That's because it's been flooded. And if you look at his watch, his has been flooded as well. I think it's because the crown that they used had some weird little thing in it, which I had to have an a real proper engineer rebuild the interior of the crown. A guy who makes parts for like jet fighters made it for me. And then he went, it will work, but it's a kind of a shit design, right?
Yeah.
So these things are why I'm not love Seiko. The modern Seikos, the modern incarnations are what those watches should have been.
Right.
Understood. Okay.
And where do you put the modern, like where do you put like a Marine Master against a Rolex Submariner? Like what are your thoughts for the modern versus
Marine Master is way above the Rolex Submariner.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Do you know which movement that wrote? Well, I don't know whether this is true now, but this is what I've heard before. Do you know, the whole thing about Rolex chronometer testing and all that for their movements?
Sure.
Do you know which movement passes that test more than any other?
I think the Seiko movement. And they stopped doing that competition once Seiko won.
No, right? Better than this. Of the Rolex movements, which type of Rolex movement passes it more than anything else?
I wouldn't know. No.
The ladies' Datejust.
Really? Wow.
Okay. Yeah. So what that tells you is, of that design, the smaller version is the most efficient of them.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah.
And why would that be?
The prospect is like, totally, it's a totally great watch. And also, there weren't many of them. You didn't see them vintage. I didn't even really know about it until probably 2012, when a proper collector that I know bought one and sent me a picture and said, this is really cool, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, wow, how have I missed that? But what I'd done was I bought a few Seikos, looked at them, evaluated them for what I did.
Yeah.
And went, because I was a dealer. I wasn't Joe Schmo who was like, well, I've got this cool watch from 72 and it works really well and all that, which is how you should be.
Sure.
I just missed them and I'd never even looked at it. But the prospect is secretly much better than that. So,
mean the Marine Master? Sorry. You've been saying prospects.
The prospect's the range, right?
Right, gotcha, right. Okay, gotcha.
But the original range only had one watch.
Yeah.
It was actually called the Prospect Marine Master, no?
Is that right, Sej? Or was it?
I might be wrong. Okay, and also, okay. I'm going to have to do the handbag thing. We're getting dirty about.
So,
when it comes to Seiko,
it's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I expected a drubbing for my Seiko love, and that this wasn't as bad as I.
Yeah.
As I was expecting, I'm okay with this.
No, I'm not a hater. I'm just like.
You do raise a good point. You do raise a good point.
It's just my experience, and also the gold poke. The first bar job I had when I just started college, I was like a student, and I was working in this bar, and it was a big bar. I had like four different things, and the guy who ran the place, he was tiny, kept coming up to me going, if you work really hard, you could run this place for me. And I'd be like, yeah, sure. I'm at college. What are you talking about? And then I had a guy called Colin, who's in charge of me. He was about 6'2 and about 350, right? And he used to stand, and he had a bold blonde haircut, and he kept brushing it to one side. When he'd be talking to you, and you'd be going, yeah. Like he was doing some kind of serious fucking thing, and he used to wear that gold poke. So that's another reason why I wouldn't buy one.
It's just bad association.
I won't be a Colin for anybody, that's all I'm saying.
On that note, all right, well, thanks again for joining us for another episode of the Land Jam podcast. If you haven't, please subscribe. If you could do us a favor, please give us a review and a rating on iTunes. It really kind of helps the podcast. And yeah, give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram. And thanks for joining.